Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
And I am here, the conscience of psychiatry, glad to be talking to the best audience in the world, psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, advocates, survivors of abuse, all listening to this show, spreading the word. Really glad to be talking to you again. Today, I have a very interesting guest. I think a lot of people are going to just, on the one hand, be shocked, on the other hand, be inspired. I think you're going to learn from this show. My guest is Wayne Douglas. Wayne is calling all the way from Japan, and we've pre-recorded this show because there's a 14-hour difference to Japan, and we're trying to accommodate him. I'm really glad to have him on. His website is Benzo Case, and the subtitle of it is Raising Awareness About Benzodiazepine Drugs. I'm going to just give the mic over to Wayne and let him tell us a story that is a story among stories about benzos. Wayne, so glad to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure, Peter. Thank you for having me. Yes, so basically my experience with benzodiazepines began back in June 2000. I was living in Japan at the time. I woke one night with vertigo. The room was spinning around and I was having difficulty standing up or even walking. And I went to the hospital the next morning and they couldn't make a diagnosis, but they gave me some medications for dizziness, for anti-nausea medication, and some vitamins and so forth. I took that for about a month, and I never really got any better. And then, I did get better slowly over time, but I never made a complete recovery. And then one day I was at home watching TV, and a guy came on who was being showcased as a leading authority in dizziness, and he was located in Tokyo. And I thought, well, perhaps if I could get to see him, then maybe he could make a clear diagnosis and I could get the help that I needed to make a full recovery. So I got the referral, and I went to see this gentleman in Tokyo. I did a little bit of research before I went to see him, and I was pretty sure that what I had was vestibular neuritis, which is inflammation in the nerve in the inner ear. And when I saw him, he said, I can see how you might think that, but I think that what you have is Sylvian aqueduct syndrome. And I found out years later that medical term isn't actually used in modern-day medicine. And then he told me that the condition was congenital. In other words, I had a predisposition to it. And he said in order to treat this condition, he would need to prescribe a cocktail of drugs, something he referred to as a radical approach. There was basically no information on the internet at the time. There was very little information available on the internet at the time, and I was still quite very ill. So being a world-renowned specialist, I decided to place my faith in the doctor's judgment and went along with the treatment. In hindsight, I know that I was prescribed three different kinds of benzodiazepines and an antidepressant and one other medication for improving blood circulation. So that was all done without informed consent, of course. I didn't even know what the drugs were. I was of the understanding that it was for treating the Sylvian aqueduct syndrome. So do you have any questions at this point, or should I carry on?
Oh, no, just keep and tell the story. carried on, and we will get to your reform work and your legal case. I mean, you've got a lot to tell us, and I'm happy to just let you talk.
Okay. So basically, the first couple of weeks, I thought there might have been some sort of settling of symptoms, certainly the anxiety surrounding my undiagnosed vertigo attack. Anyway, I was obviously anxious over that because I was thinking the worst and didn't know what the cause was. And so after about 6 weeks, there was very little change. And in fact, I developed a new symptom, which was palpitations. And I informed the doctor about that. And I saw him once a month, and he kept topping up the prescription, saying that the drugs won't work immediately, that it would take some time, but I'll definitely make a full recovery. So I continued to have faith in him. Then between about 4 and 6 months, I started developing a whole host of new symptoms. For the first time in my life ever, I developed psychological symptoms such as mood swings, difficulty concentrating, panic attacks, severe anxiety, all kinds of things, and various other physical symptoms as well, including pressure in the chest, tingling sensation, a lot of visual disturbances. All my vision was blurry, grainy. I even developed this really weird sensation that I was seeing my environment in a sequence of snapshots, like a sequence of snapshots you take on a camera. It was very almost robotic. My focus was delayed. It was really weird.
Now, and, at this point, Wayne, you're on. Let's go over the drugs one by one.
Yeah.
Can you tell us exactly what you were on at that point?
Yeah. Sure. So, years later, I found out that what I was given was clonazepam. I think it's called Clonopin over there in the U.S., otherwise known as Rivotril. I was given another one prescribed in Japan called Tofisipam. I heard that it's made in China. And
that's another benzo?
That's another benzodiazepine.
A Chinese benzo, okay.
Yeah, apparently it's manufactured in China. This is all, obviously, these are all things I found out later. And I was given another one, chloroidepoxide or something.
I'm not sure what that is.
Chlordiazepoxide or something.
So was that another benzo?
Yeah, that's another benzodiazepine.
He was giving you three at a time?
Yeah, three at a time, and get this, they were all mixed together in powder form and dispensed in sachets. So it was they were dispensed in sachets in powder form, so three different benzos mixed together in powder form. Yeah, and also an antidepressant. And I mean, obviously,
yeah,
I wasn't really
familiar with it, but chlordiazepoxide is a benzo, plain old benzo. Yeah.
Yeah, it's called, the brand name is Grandexin. Yeah. I was given this benzo pack basically, and I was taking that three times a day. And then eventually I just ended up a total mess, and I just got to the point where I couldn't function. I was completely burnt out. I could barely make it to work. And in the last month or so, I ended up taking a taxi to work because I just couldn't cycle. I couldn't hardly walk. I couldn't really bear to be in the crowded Tokyo stations. And so I ended up getting taxis. And then eventually just got to the point where I had 1 week of work left, and I said to my boss, look, I've just got to get on the plane and get out of here because I could just, you know, fall to bits at any second. And he agreed and he let me go. And I remember on my last day of work, well, when I was cleaning out my apartment, I threw away absolutely everything. I threw away all of my possessions, all of my photos. I just felt so disgusted and dirty that I just wanted to leave everything behind. I didn't want to take anything with me that reminded me or that I could associate with that point in time. And I remember my last day at work, I basically broke down on the desk and cried, and I apologized to everyone. It was never meant to be this way. This is not me. You haven't seen the real me. They had high hopes for me. I had a good work record. And I remember the last day, I was getting the train out to the airport, and I had to change trains along the way. And I stopped at one of the stations, and I took off all my work clothes and put them into a rubbish bin, shoes and everything, got changed into some trainers and some sports shoes, and I just went home with my passport and ticket, and that was it. And I told the lady on the airplane, I said, look, I'm really, really not well at all, and she was really good. She checked on me quite regularly on the flight home. And then when I got back to New Zealand, I got a local flight to where my mother lives, and she came up to the airport to see me, and she waited purposely waited for every single person to get off the plane, and she didn't recognize me. And then I was basically the last person left, and she just looked around and she says, oh my God. And she came over and gave me a big hug, and she says, God, I didn't even recognize you. And she said, later she told me that I looked like a half-dead zombie. And, I'd lost 20 kilograms in weight, and I was gaunt, and lost color in my face.
Did you have any idea at this point that it was the drugs?
Well, I had my suspicions because I made a couple of attempts at stopping them, and I was unable to do so because when I attempted to stop them, all the symptoms intensified again. And I just had this instinct that I just needed to keep taking them, and I'm so glad for that, because if I had have gone cold turkey, I mean, I know now with the benefit of hindsight that all hell could have broken loose. So I'm really glad that I had the wherewithal to actually keep taking them until I could seek the proper help. Oh, by the way, actually in Japan, I tried to get away from that doctor, and I tried changing hospitals. And when I changed hospitals and told him, you know, about my the recent history and my symptoms getting worse and everything, and I thought it was the drugs, he actually gave some other bogus diagnosis, and he prescribed yet more benzodiazepines. And he prescribed me the clonazepam or the clonopin, as well as aprazolam or Xanax, which is about 10 to 20 times stronger than diazepam. So, and he wanted to give me another one as well, bropazepam, as a sleeping tablet. So I actually said to him, look, I think it's the drugs that are causing the problems, and I want to keep them to a minimum if I can. So he said, okay, well, you can do away with the bropazepam or something or other at night. And so I didn't take that at all. And then I went back to New Zealand. So basically, I just couldn't get the help that I needed. They wouldn't know dependency if they stood on it. I mean, they didn't have a clue. Most Japanese doctors think that these drugs are just not dependence forming at all, and they think they said they're perfectly safe. You can come off them. You can stop. You can make an abrupt cessation with no problems at all. That's what the doctors here believe. So I'm glad that I had the wherewithal to keep taking them. And then I went back to New Zealand.
Let me take a minute now and just sort of digest with you. You know, one of the things that that I'm learning more and more about, even as I get on in years and decades of having done this, is that psychiatric drugs are poisonous. It doesn't matter what class you're in of drugs. All the frequently used, commonly used drugs are poisonous, whether we're talking about the benzos or the antipsychotic drugs, the mood stabilizers, the stimulants. It doesn't matter. All of these drugs cross the blood-brain barrier, and then they proceed to inflict toxicity upon the brain. And they work in various and different ways, and they disrupt various and different processes. But all of them are very confusing. All of them, because they're making our brain and mind, which are so complex, because they're making them toxic, the vast arrays of symptoms are going to vary from person to person. And I mean, you got this interesting symptom of seeing things, of, I guess you were saying, like photograph sequences moving along. I think you said something like that.
Yeah, that's right.
everybody will get different when they get toxic. They're going to get different symptoms. And it gives doctors, unfortunately, an excuse for thinking that the patient's, quote, crazy. It gives family, gets family confused, and it gets the patient confused.
Exactly.
Just keep that in mind, folks. Those of you who are taking psychiatric drugs, you may not be getting a gross mismanagement of this type that we're seeing in Wayne's case, but if the drug is working, if you're getting enough of a dose to working, it's disrupting your brain function, and to some degree, you're getting something of what Wayne's describing in one way or another, including this very graphic description he's giving of just not being comfortable in his life somehow, of not belonging in the life he's in or something along those lines. So we'll go on. We've got you now back home in New Zealand. Your mother's picked you up at the airport. You're a wreck.
Yeah.
You're on three or four benzos.
I was on three benzos and an antidepressant. And
what was the antidepressant?
Something. What was it? It was an SSRI. I'm not sure what the name was, to be honest. I can't
really
remember.
That'll just add all kinds of new toxicities to the brew. Okay.
Yeah, right.
At this point, I would say, folks, that the man's future is on the rocks. It's going to be a miracle if somebody rescues him or he rescues himself. So on with the story.
Yeah, sure. You just reminded me of something, actually. I found out later the reason why I was getting a lot of these symptoms during the treatment. And I actually had a lot of contact with Professor Heather Ashton over the years, and I've learned a lot from her. And in hindsight, I developed tolerance to the drugs quite quickly, and I was actually getting withdrawal reactions even though I was still taking the drugs because the drugs had lost their effect. So I was actually getting a withdrawal reaction. So I was getting a mixture of side effects and withdrawal symptoms during the treatment. And
By the way, Wayne, I think you're up a little too – I meant to tell you this earlier. I think you're up a little too close to your mic, so we're just getting a little bit of noise from that.
Okay. I just moved it away. Okay. Please let me know if
that's all part of the life here. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. So, anyway, I'm back home, and I decided, being back in the comfort of home after a week, that I'd have another go at stopping the drugs. And again, I was unable to stop because the symptoms all intensified again. So I thought it was time to go down and see my local GP. My local GP only lives about 100 meters down the road from my mum's house, but I was unable to walk that far at the time. I was walking around like a drunk, by the way, staggering everywhere.
Yeah, of course.
So the dizziness didn't improve at all on the drugs. I went down to see my local GP, and I gave him a translation of the drugs that I was on. He just took one look at them and he says, "Well, for a start, you're suffering from benzodiazepine dependency and probably withdrawal symptoms." And so he started me off on a slow reduction and gave me some information about the drugs, and it wasn't going too well, so he referred me to the local hospital where they have a drug detox center, alcohol and drug rehabilitation center. So I saw the clinical director there and underwent a gradual taper under his direction. And once I found out what the drugs were and that I'd been cheated by the doctor, I wanted to get off those drugs real quick, and I'm a very determined person, and I just wanted to get off them as soon as I could. In hindsight, that wasn't a smart move because it takes a long time for your body to make all the necessary adaptations and to readjust. And indeed, tapering too fast can result in a protracted withdrawal symptom and an intensifying of symptoms. But anyway, I tapered as quickly as I could and as safely as I could. That was a very difficult time because, yes, the symptoms did intensify and I developed some new ones, and among the new ones were myoclonic jerks, so involuntary body movements, especially on the onset of sleep. So my body would jerk around. I got new, what else did I get? Tingling sensations over various parts of the body. It's difficult to try and remember everything now because it was about 15 years ago. but various other new symptoms. And then the psychological symptoms were really intense. I can remember arguing with my mother over what were trivial things, and it was very difficult for her because she lives alone. She's elderly. She was almost on the. She was almost ready to retire. Arguing with her, she started smoking again for the first time in 20 years, and there were episodes where we argued and she cried and I cried, and then I remember one night watching TV and everything. I was sensitive to sound and light, and I kept saying, turn down the TV, and she was going, it's not loud, and I say, can we change the channel? The lights are too bright on that program, and she was going, but I was watching that. And so, I mean, you're sensitive to everything, and I remember one night just watching TV, just rocking back and forth in the chair, and I just kept saying to myself, I felt like I was going to explode, and I wanted to run away, but where do you run to? That's home. And unlike a physical injury like a broken arm or something, you might be able to get some comfort by placing it on a pillow or changing your posture, but with drug dependency, it doesn't matter what you do, where you go, whether you stand or sit, I mean, it's just ongoing and relentless, and it's 24/7, and it's just hell. And I remember one night just rocking backwards and forwards in the chair, just saying to myself, God, I hope I don't lose control and hurt Mum. God, I hope I don't lose control and hurt Mum. And it was just taking all of my power just to stay in control. I'm usually a very strong person, and I've got a strong character, and I tell you, it took everything I had to hold it all together.
Well, it's called disinhibition. It comes from, the dysfunction of the frontal lobes that these drugs cause. By the way, folks, the chlordiazepoxide, epoxide, I'm very familiar with. It's good old Librium. It's been so long. Earlier in the show, that came up, and I'm a little embarrassed. I usually am able to identify any drug that's brought up. And frankly, I'm sure I prescribed a fair amount of that under my residency training program. That's how far back chlordiazepoxide epoxide goes. I'm going to be just commenting on things you say because I want to just, put what you're saying into a broader context. Folks, as bizarre as all of this sounds, this happens all the time in the United States as well. I mean, Wayne's case probably wouldn't be mimicked here in the U.S. from 15 years ago too often. It sounds like it was more common in Japan. When he got to New Zealand, his doc, immediately recognized what was going on. So to some extent, it's a cultural difference. But everything Wayne has been going through, people go through throughout Canada, Great Britain, the U.S., just being on one benzo and being on it for months or years and then trying to get off of it, everything he's describing can happen. So continue now with what happened to you.
Yeah, sure. So after that, I began the withdrawal phase, and so I was doing the slow taper and the intensifying of all the symptoms and everything. What I found is, at the very beginning, I could do very little at all. I mean, at most, I could vacuum the floor if I was lucky. Slow progress, month after month. Eventually, I became a little bit more mobile, taking short walks. And then I wanted to get back into the gym because I've always been into the gym since I was about 14 years old. And it's always been something that I've gravitated towards and that sort of helps me overcome things. And so I went to the, I got my mum to take me to the local gym, and I kind of staggered in like a drunk, and I said I'd like to join, and they just looked at me, still very frail and weak, and they says, God, you're in no condition to join the gym. And I said, oh, look, I really need to, please. And they said, well, if you get a doctor's letter, we might consider it. So I got a letter from my doctor, and they let me join the gym, and I went in a few times a week, and I could do, all I did was sit on the machines with no weights and just go through the movements. And then I went from there and I built it up, and I started going for longer walks, and then eventually into a bit of jogging. And I must say that recovery was never a consistent process, it was always a case of the symptoms waxing and waning and having windows, so periods where you sort of felt a bit better and then it gets worse. So there was a lot of ups and downs and waves and troughs and everything.
Yeah. And I thought that Wayne, was quite bizarre. Wayne, back up just a little more from your mic. Your voice is very strong and very clear. Okay. So you're coming across really good.
I was quite surprised because I thought that I might get better. It might be a consistent recovery, but it wasn't. And I found out later that that's typical in benzodiazepine withdrawal, that the symptoms do wax and wane. And you have waves and troughs and windows of feeling well again, and it's a very much up-down affair, and it takes a long time.
Yeah. Wayne, it's a neurologic injury, and that's a characteristic of injuries to the brain that also obviously affect the mind. It's recovery is often very slow but can be very good, and it is an up-and-down affair.
Yeah, yeah. So it took an entire year to get over the worst of it. I still had symptoms after that, like the panic attacks lasted a long time. After a year, I managed to get some part-time work and move into the city, and that was the first time to try and get back to some normality. I only worked part-time, but outside of work, I could do very little at all. I just basically went home and went to sleep. And it took a long time, but over the years, I slowly built up to more towards full-time work, and I started studying again, and my gym training picked up. And then it was about 3 years later that my gym training really picked up quite a lot, and I was right back to where I sort of was, and then I started hiking and doing full-day hikes in the mountains. So my dizziness actually improved about a year after stopping the drugs. It actually went from ongoing dizziness to periodic dizziness, and after a couple of years it recovered completely. So my original complaint recovered in the absence of the drugs. It didn't get better on the drugs. In fact, it got worse on the drugs, and my original complaint, I recovered from my original complaint after the drugs were stopped.
What do you think your dizziness is from in retrospect?
Oh, I believe it was inflammation of the nerve in the ear. So vestibular neuronitis, it's called. I strongly believe that, and I've seen various other physicians after, and they all agree that that's what it would have been.
Yeah.
So the diagnosis was completely wrong, and the drugs were not suited to the incorrect diagnosis, nor were they suited to what I actually had. So either way, the drugs were completely a mismatch. And so I felt cheated. I felt violated. And I honestly can say what it must... I could, for the first time in my life, I could understand how it must feel for a woman to be violated, because that's how I felt. This guy basically messed with my body against my will and interfered with my well-being, and I was really annoyed. I was really angry. I felt really cheated. And I thought, something's got to be done about this, because it's not just happening to me, it's happening to other people as well. And then that's when I got the idea of I should start pursuing a legal case.
Now let me take a breath with you and say, now how many years, just so the folks listening know, how long did it take you to feel normal? If you have, did you eventually return to feeling just like your old self or better?
Well, that took a long time, because I actually felt relatively well maybe about 3 years later, but not 100%. I mean, I used to, in the gym sessions with my friend, he used to say to me, he used to say, oh, this is me talking to you, and this is you. This is you, Wayne. Oh, I hear what you're saying, but all I hear is wah, wah, wah. I mean, I still had foggy brain. I still wasn't there, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. I want folks listening to know that, you know, it can take you time to recover. This is just very, very important. And that recovery can continue. It can be gradual. It can happen in spurts. But whatever psychiatric drug you've come off, and again, virtually every psychiatric drug requires tapering. I talk about that a lot in my book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. And it just can take you time to recover. So, you know, be strong. And Also exercise, I would say mostly moderate exercise, and eat 3 square meals a day, and avoid even taking taking herbs and alternative stuff. I don't know what you did, Wayne, but it can be hazardous to you know, to take anything that affects your brain when you're trying to clear up your brain and mind and to come off drugs. There's an herb that's very highly touted among alternative health people, ashwagandha, and you know, I've seen people get benzo withdrawal coming off ashwagandha. So you just got to check out, and don't just listen to your doctor or even to your natural healer necessarily. Go look up the drug, and you. One of the best ways to go is, frankly, is just Google, because there's going to be things rattling around on the internet that will alert you to look deeper, and you can be fairly sure that your prescriber may not have even gone to the trouble lately of Google, but is mostly listening to what he hears from paid company reps at conferences. And from what the salesperson in his office is telling him. So we're with Wayne now, and you're about 4 years out at this point from when you decide you want some redress?
Yeah, actually, I think I started thinking about it about 3 years after. And I must agree with you, Peter, that I think the best thing for my recovery was regularity in my life. So the 3 meals a day, trying to get go to bed at the same time, even if you're not sleeping, just try to get into that habit, because I think your body responds to the regularity. And just building up the exercise as you can. I mean, at first, some people may not be able to do much at all, but I mean, even just starting off with stretching or something and just slowly building it up and keeping that regularity, and I think your body responds to that regularity. So I found that was really useful for me. But anyway, yes, I started thinking about the litigation about 3 years later, and I started preparing documents. And then, so I prepared for my case for about a year and a half.
Well, you're in New Zealand, and the case is going to be in Japan, right?
That's right. That's right.
Bit of a handicap. Do you speak Japanese?
Yeah. That was a huge psychological barrier for me, because I was getting ready to go back to Japan. I mean, the country where it all happened. So, I was training in the gym quite hard, and I remember after my gym sessions, I'd go into the sauna and I'd meditate, and I'd say, oh no, so that came later down the track. Sorry, I'm getting a bit ahead of myself. No, so I eventually went back to Japan, and I went to Nagano and got myself set up in a job, and then I started preparing for my case. And
yeah, do you speak Japanese?
Yes, I actually graduated I actually majored in Japanese at university.
Yeah,
so...
Is there still a barrier? I mean, that's a tough language, isn't it?
Yes, it's a very different language. And yes, it is. It's difficult to learn, and especially to read and write. But I actually did quite well in my studies. And so I didn't really feel that much of a language barrier, to be honest. I didn't think that had any bearing on my medical treatment.
And that hadn't been injured by all these drugs you didn't mean to take. Your language was there, still there. Your second language was still there.
Yeah, it was still there. Yeah.
Good.
And yeah. So I came back to Japan and I made some inquiries about how to pursue litigation. And they suggested that I try mediation first. And I went along to mediation, and the doctor never showed. And I was not represented. I had no legal representation. And I went along a couple of times, and the doctor never showed. And he just said, oh, he's just out to cause trouble. And then one day, there was an assistant at the court, and he said, you don't have any representation, do you? And I said, no. And he goes, well, come with me down to the legal aid office, and we'll see if we can get you a lawyer. And to be honest, I was having relapses of withdrawal at that point, and I was burnt out again, and I was getting ready to go home already. And I had actually already booked my airfare to go back to New Zealand the next day. And then they introduced this lawyer, and then everything changed. And so I cancelled my airfare and decided to stay. And then my lawyer took my case over, and we went through mediation for about 2 years, I think it was. And the doctor eventually showed up. And so we were taking a case out against the doctor and the hospital, two separate parties. And that was a difficult time because I was having to relive all the trauma, and it was causing relapses of withdrawal, and I was waking up in the mornings with intense nausea for months on end. I was just dry reaching every morning. And then I found a way around that, actually. I actually set my alarm and got up before the nausea set in, and then I went off for a jog before the nausea had a chance to take hold, and it actually worked. I managed to avoid it. But, yeah, so that was 2 years, and then eventually at the end, the mediator says, look, I think you've got a case, and I think the doctor's accountable. But the doctor at the end said, I'm not going to give Wayne a single yen, or in other words, a single cent. And we thought, well, if that's the case, we'll see you in court. So we lodged for proceedings at the Tokyo District Court, and we spent another year or 2 years in the Tokyo District Court, and I had changed jobs by that point, and I'd gone up to Fukushima to work for a Japanese government agency at a training center, teaching English to overseas volunteers before they're dispatched overseas. And so that was an incredibly challenging time because the job itself was challenging, but I was also proceeding with my court case at the same time. So that was incredibly challenging. It took a massive amount of time management and stress management. It was incredible. Incredibly challenging, but I did it. I got through. And then
it's amazing persistence you were displaying, just courage and persistence.
Oh, it was extremely challenging in many ways. But once again, it was the exercise in the gym. I come back to it. That's what got me through, and just going for walks in nature, taking a hot spring, going up to the lake for a swim. But I didn't really have time for much of that, to be honest. It was just when I could. I was just so busy all the time. And then, of course, I got to the point where my brain wouldn't shut down and I was having difficulty sleeping. But then I devised a way that I had these mental boxes, and I thought, well, while I'm at work, my work box is open and that's all I'm thinking about. Then I come home, and then my court case box is open, so that's all I'm thinking about. But then come night time to go to sleep, all my boxes are closed. So any thoughts creep and I go, nope, that box closed, sorry. And then eventually I'd fall off to sleep. So that kind of worked for me. I kind of found that what worked for me, and it did work. And anyway, it was an extremely difficult time, a couple of years, having to cook like enough meals for 4 nights in a row because I didn't have time to cook, doing your washing on a Friday night so you could hang it up first thing on a Saturday morning, just all these little things. It just had to, time management had to be impeccable. But it was incredibly challenging, and my lawyer was a very aggressive lawyer with a short temper, and I was working between him and the New Zealand doctor, who was very sensitive, so I found myself stuck in the middle, not only between cultures and languages, but between these two different personalities. My God, it was challenging, very challenging. So anyway, the Tokyo District Court verdict was eventually read, and they denied my case. They said that the doctor wasn't accountable because they said that dependency on these drugs was not recognized medical knowledge in Japan, therefore the doctor's not accountable. And so we lodged for the Tokyo High Court, and I spent another 2 years in the Tokyo High Court, and once again that was very challenging, but I'd become kind of used to the way things, the proceedings by that point. Actually, I've got to back up, Peter. I've got to back up. Because during that challenging time during the district court, I actually burnt out. I did burn out at one point, and I had to go back to New Zealand for a year. I had to take a year off.
My God.
And my lawyer kept representing me. Sorry, I forgot all about that. Mm. My lawyer kept representing me. I had to go back to New Zealand for time out. So I took
now,
time
do you,
out.
Do you think that the degree of stress you were feeling was partially because your brain was still not back to its past strength, or was it just so overwhelming?
I think definitely both. And I mean, Professor Ashton's always told me that once you've been given drugs like this, they sensitize you and you become more sensitive or prone to stress than you were originally. And definitely I was more prone to stress, and definitely I was overloaded as well. So I think it was a combination. And I went back to New Zealand for another year, and I got back into my training and just get grounded again. And I was living fairly close to the beach in the mountains, so just got into my hikes again and getting grounded, and then back into the gym. And then after about 6 months, a date had been set for my testimony, and I really stepped up my gym training. And after each session, I'd go into the sauna, because the testimony was set for September 12th, and I know it's still quite hot in Japan during that time.
Now, last time we were with your story, you were going to the high court. Now, in the U.S., there's no testimony before the Supreme Court or other high courts.
Yeah, yeah.
So where were you at the time you're testifying?
Yeah. So this was in the district court, the Tokyo District Court.
Okay.
So I had to back up a little bit, sorry. So I spent another year back home, and then once a date had been set for my testimony, I began basically physical and mental training, and I'd sit in the sauna in the gym, and I'd say to myself, I'm in Tokyo, I'm in the Tokyo court, it's hot, but I'm fine. I'm in Tokyo, I'm in court, it's hot, but I'm fine. And I did that for about 6 months. And eventually, I had to try and get my airfare to go back and testify, and I just couldn't get money anywhere. The banks wouldn't lend me any money. I couldn't get a loan anywhere. And I was just really tired and quite didn't know what to do. I was at a loss, and I just went to visit a friend at work, and she said, "You look really down. What's wrong?" And I told her, and she just wrote down on the piece of paper, and she slid it across the desk, and she said, "Will this do it?" And I looked at it, and I said, "Unbelievable. That's awesome. Thank you." And so she wrote out a check. She lent me the money. I went down cashed it and booked my airfare and managed to make it back to Japan by the skin of my teeth. I didn't think I was going to make it to testify. So anyway, I come back to Japan and I meet with my lawyer for a few rehearsals. And then on the morning of the testimony, I went to his office and we got a taxi to the Tokyo District Court. And basically walked into the courthouse and everyone was going, "God, it's hot. It's hot in here." And everyone was sweating. And I said, "Oh, it's not hot at all." And it's really unusual because usually I feel the heat more than anyone. And then someone said, "Oh, the air conditioner's broken." And it just didn't really faze me. And usually I'd be really worried at that point. But we went through the testimony and it took about 2 or 3 hours. And we had a recess and everyone was drinking water and wiping the sweat off their brow. And then after it was all finished, we went out to a restaurant for a meal, and then everyone had a toast with a cold drink. And just when we went cheers, and I put my glass down, then it just hit me. I just broke out into a sweat, and I thought, "My God, it's so hot in here." So it was really incredible. I couldn't believe it. And
You'd actually suppressed your autonomic nervous system through sheer willpower.
Yeah, that's right, and it's the first time for me because I haven't done any sports training or anything like that. I unwittingly prepared myself for it. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe how powerful the mind can be. You know, I was surprised.
Yeah,
really. Yeah, it was amazing. So anyway, after the testimony, I think my court case continued for about another 6 months or so, and then the verdict was read in. As I said, they ruled it out on the basis that dependency to these drugs is not medical knowledge in Japan, so the doctor was not accountable. So we lodged for the Tokyo High Court, and that went on for about another almost 2 years. And so once again, I was back up in Fukushima. And yeah, so that continued for another 2 years, but by that time I'd sort of got used to the way things were, and I managed to work my way through to the end of it reasonably well. The Tokyo High Court was delivered in February 2011, and it was just a shambles, the whole thing. I mean, They just cut a lot of the symptoms out. They left out some diagnostic criteria. I mean, I made a list of 17 different injustices, absolutely clear-cut injustices. I mean, they just got no shame. It was a disgrace. The verdict was an absolute disgrace. I mean, I'm sure an elementary school child could have done better than that. Couldn't believe it. It was just clear-cut injustice. They just did not want to give any recognition to my case at all.
Yeah.
So
sounds well, a lot like something that could happen in the U.S. very easily.
Yeah, well, I think it happens in a lot of places, Peter. I think it happens to a lot of people. I've heard a lot of stories since then.
Yeah.
And it seems to be quite common. No one wants to take accountability or even recognize that.
Well, the power of the pharmaceutical industry all over the world. You know, Japan has its own giant pharmaceutical firms, and the power is just the control over our culture, our society, our courts, our educational system. You know, what I call the psychopharmaceutical complex, just you can't exaggerate the power. It's stunning.
You're right. It's just amazing. It's unbelievable. Yeah. So anyway, that was, of course, just before March 11, which is when the big earthquake struck Fukushima or northern Japan, and I was there, and I'd been working at the government training facility for quite a few years at that point. I'd never taken so much as a minute off work, but that particular morning I had food poisoning, and so I had to take a little bit of time off. And it was graduation day for our students, so it wasn't really a problem, but I made the effort to go up and say goodbye to them anyway. And my employer said, "Oh, are you feeling any better?" And I said, "No." And he goes, "Well, go back home and lay down." I was actually working on my Supreme Court appeal at that point, or getting ready to. I think I'd already started preparations for it, actually. And I went home and I was laying down. This was March 11, Friday, March 11. And as the clock clicked towards 2:50 in the afternoon, then my apartment started shaking. And we'd had quite a lot of earthquakes in the months before. And I thought, I waited for a while and I thought, something's different about this one. I better get up. So I got out of bed and sort of stood in the dining room halfway between my room and the front door. And I thought, well, I'll just wait for a minute and see what it does. Then all of a sudden it started shaking quite violently. And I thought, no, I've got to get out of here. So I ran out to the front of the house. And then everything was just shaking, the whole house. It was just shaking so violently. And just when you think it couldn't get any worse, then it just doubled in intensity. And I honestly thought the whole house was just going to shatter into a trillion pieces. And it felt like the ground was moving. Ground swells felt like it was moving almost a meter up and down. It was like standing in a boat. And what was running through my head at the time was the Fukushima nuclear power plant. I just thought, nothing can survive that. Something's got to be wrong. But I didn't panic because I really had no money and I couldn't really go anywhere. I'd spent all my salary on my court case. And I thought, well, I won't panic. I'll just stay put and try to get some information. So I stayed the night, and there were aftershocks. I felt like every 2 minutes all night, and everyone's cell phones were buzzing and beeping, all the earthquake alarms beeping all the time, and you could hear all the aftershocks come rolling in over the night, sounding like a freight train rolling in, and then the whole house would start shaking, and that would go on every few minutes. And then the next day, finally, the electricity came back on. And I turned the TV on, and they said, "Oh, there's been an accident at the Fukushima nuclear power plant, but everything's okay." It's all I needed to hear. So I packed a sports bag and went down to the community center and said to another teacher, I said, "I'll take you to your house in Goodman now if I can stay with you for a week." And he said, "Done." So we also offered to take another couple of teachers who wanted to get out of town because all the public transport was down. And we drove for hours and hours all night. You could see all the roads were torn up, the highway was closed. And as we were driving out of town, actually it came over the radio that there had been an explosion. And after they announced that, the song by Eric Clapton came on, Tears in Heaven. It was a very somber moment. Everyone just went silent. And we just kept driving through all the road, which was was all head cracks and everything in it. And we drove for most of the night. We dropped a couple of friends off at a train station. We finally got to my friend's apartment. And aftershocks just continued for days, and they were having rotational power cuts. So I was writing my Supreme Court appeal in all these aftershocks.
God.
Yeah, all in Japanese.
Yeah. Of course, so much makes me anxious, so I laugh. It's unbelievable what you went through.
Yeah. So basically, during the power cuts, I was writing notes by candlelight. And then when the electricity came back on, I was typing my notes onto my laptop computer in between trying to get updates on the nuclear power plants, which were exploding one after another. My friend didn't have a TV. He had a little portable TV that he used to keep in his laboratory. And it was almost the size of the screen was almost the size of a matchbox. I mean, you could hardly make out anything at all, but at least it had sound. And so I was trying to get updates on what was happening in Fukushima, and I was ringing up my friends in Fukushima saying, get out of there, get out of there. And the phones were jamming up, and it was crazy. And I was writing my Supreme Court appeal while all this was going on, nuclear fallout and power cuts, and it was just mad. And so eventually our work was relocated to Osaka, and I was able to relocate down there. But to cut a long story short, I ended up shifting apartments something like 7 times in the space of 6 months that followed. And then eventually I ended up in evacuee housing. I lost my job. A lot of us lost our jobs. And I ended up in evacuee housing in Nagano, which is where I'm at now. And I've been here for about 4.5 years since. I've only been working part-time. I managed to submit my Supreme Court appeal from when I was in Osaka, and it was a shoebox full, 9 copies of documents, all in Japanese, which I sent to the Supreme Court of Japan. And I finally got a reply saying, sorry, your case cannot proceed because there was no infringement against the Constitution. And I rang up the court secretary and I said, not allowing the doctor to testify, that was the New Zealand doctor, denying your key witness the opportunity to testify on 2 occasions, once in the district court and once in the high court, does that not form a infringement against the Constitution? And he said, well, whether it does or not is up to the judge. And that's how it ended. That was the end of the court case. And then, so I find myself in evacuee housing with my whole world having caved in around me, so I no longer had a job. My court case was all over. Here I am, 46 years old, alone in a foreign country, living in state housing, in evacuee housing, with absolutely nothing. No money, no family, no assets, no nothing. Is this what I learnt Japanese for? Is this what I went back to school for, an adult student, and learnt Japanese? Is this what it all comes down to? And I thought, no way, it's not going to end like this. And that's when I started campaigning. So, yeah, I tried.
Talent, we have about 3.5 minutes left. I get the sense that you think it was worth fighting up through the courts. Can you say a word about that?
Actually, what I'd really like to do, Peter, if it's all possible, it's really unfortunate we're running out of time because I really wanted to talk about World Benzodiazepine Awareness Day, which is what I've just helped organize and has just happened on July 11th.
Go ahead.
A lot of people in similar situations to me, or a lot worse situations to me. I mean, I've heard some terrible stories. People are just bedridden and they're just, you know, taking these drugs as prescribed by their doctors, and they're just not getting the help they need. In fact, they're being cold turkeyed, and it's just ridiculous. So we've set up World Benzodiazepine Awareness Day to try and help raise awareness, and that was just held on July 11th, which is Professor Ashton's birthday. And so this is going to be an annual event, and we welcome anyone to help raise awareness on this day. And of course, you can continue to raise awareness every other day as well, but in particular on this day, it would be great if people could help to raise awareness about benzodiazepines and indeed other psychotropic drugs as well. And I think it was a reasonable success, the inaugural event, and we hope it's going to grow year by year because, as you say, we can't see the governments creating this change because they're just too interested in the money, I think, and they don't want to take any accountability. And I think the only change is going to come from the people. And it's people need to speak up. People need to say, this is what's going on. This is what happens to me. It's just not good enough. People need to speak up, unite, and just say no.
They can get in touch with you at Benzo Case. Can they get in touch with you through your website in Japan?
Yes.
We're talking to Wayne Douglas. Wayne Douglas from Japan. Very kindly worked out with me getting on the show today. Wayne, you take a minute now. Just finish up. I want to just, well, you know, hey, just give us a summary sentence of what your feeling is at the present time.
I feel like I've been let down by the systems, by the medical system, by the legal system, and it's just amazing that so many people are damaged and harmed by these drugs, but people just turn a blind eye. The politicians are doing nothing about it. I mean, your average person in the street, they just turned a blind eye. It's almost like there's social stigma attached, and it's just not good enough to turn the blind eye, you know. It's like one of those social stigma that's like domestic violence or rape or anything like that. You can't just turn a blind eye. You can't. You have to face up. You have to face up and realize that there's a problem, and that's the only time something can be done about it is when you actually realize that there's a problem. Face up. Do something. That's my
message. I want to thank you, Wayne, for your courage, your persistence. You've done a really good job today of presenting to people what it's like to go through this kind of trauma, and it is going on throughout the world. Again, thank you, Wayne Douglas. You can find him at Benzo Case.
Thank you very much, Peter. It was nice speaking to you.